tuned to the Tuesday morning radio zine. Julie Sabatier hosts, interviews David Bloom, international ethanol expert.
This is Julie Sabatier, and this morning I'll be speaking with David Bloom. He's the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. David, are you there?
Yes, I am, Julie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I understand an updated version of this book is going to be published by the New Society Publishers, and it's supposed to hit stores in July. Is that right?
Well, it's a little bit behind schedule, but it'll certainly make it out there in September or so.
Oh, great.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't have a lot of time, only 30 minutes to talk about this fascinating topic. So why don't you just start off by telling us a few reasons why alcohol is a better fuel than gasoline?
Well, alcohol has always been a better fuel than gasoline. Alcohol was the first auto fuel long before gasoline was ever invented. And alcohol is basically liquid solar energy. And what I mean by that is we make alcohol, otherwise known as moonshine, from plants. And the way plants do this is they take sunlight, mix it with carbon dioxide from the air and water during photosynthesis, and they make carbohydrates, or basically sugar. And plants take that sugar and can make a lot of things with it, like starch or cellulose. And we can take that sugar and ferment it, kind of in a process similar to making beer or wine, and then distill it as if we were making whiskey, and we have fuel that we can run in our vehicles.
Great, great. And can you tell us a little bit about the history of alcohol as a fuel?
Well, yeah, you know, the internal combustion engine came along long before oil was discovered. The internal combustion engine originally was used in mines using coal gas. And when it was first put into a vehicle, gasoline still didn't exist, and alcohol was the fuel that was used. The Model A and the Model T, for instance, the first cars that Ford had on the road, were able to run on alcohol and on gasoline in a pinch. So when you were in the city, which is where Rockefeller distributed gasoline, you would run in one way, and then when you went out to the country for a ride to get home, you'd stop at almost any farm, pick up alcohol, and then you can make a couple of adjustments from inside the cab of your car, and you could get home on alcohol. And basically the adjustments were simple. There was a knob on the dash that went all the way down to the carburetor, and you were able to adjust the air-fuel mixture because alcohol needs less air than gasoline. And you would use your digital distributor to change the spark advance. You'd take the five digits of your left hand and shift a lever, and you could go ahead and run on alcohol.
Great. And alcohol as a fuel faced some opposition throughout history.
Well, yes, alcohol has been probably subject to the longest running disinformation campaign by corporations ever, more than 100 years. Alcohol was favored by, as I mentioned, Henry Ford and people who saw farming as the core of America's economy. You got to realize back in the early 1900s, late 1800s, you know, 40% of the population was directly or indirectly related to farming. So Henry Ford used to say, if we can't be the customer of the farmer, how can he be our customer? In other words, how could Ford sell cars to them? So he really pushed alcohol as a fuel for vehicles. Rockefeller had a different opinion about that, and he was a pretty tough competitor, and at one point he decided to stop playing fair. He funded a bunch of little old ladies called the Women's Christian Temperance Movement, and they went ahead and bought Congress with the money that they got from Rockefeller, over $4 million, and got a constitutional amendment passed prohibiting the production of alcohol, which nowadays we call prohibition. And it took over 13 years to get that repealed and for alcohol to be then available once again as a fuel.
And you yourself, you face some censorship issues with your material, I understand.
Well, I'm not the only one. I mean, lots of people over time have had their information repressed by by the forces of big oil. For instance, the agricultural extension system in the United States, you know, the whole advice system for farmers was founded on Rockefeller grants with the express condition that the Department of Agriculture would not advise farmers on alcohol fuel, you know, making sure they couldn't get the information to compete with them. And in my case, I did a lot of this teaching of alcohol fuel production back in the late 70s and taught over 180 workshops all over the country to about 8,000 farmers, and went to do a PBS series on the subject, and we did all 10 half-hour shows on how to produce alcohol, and went on the air in San Francisco in 83. And while it was on the air, and I was actually in Portland getting the book printed, or starting to get the book printed, we got a call at the printer saying, stop the presses. And when we got back to San Francisco, we discovered that the series had been canceled for release to all the rest of the PBS network. And the book advertisement at the end of the series in the San Francisco airing of the series had been removed. So basically what happened was oil companies who sponsored the San Francisco station called up and said something to the effect of, what's wrong, you don't like our money? And that's all it took to get it stopped back in 83. So if we would have had that series on the air in 83 and we would have gone ahead and, you know, basically informed farmers all over the country on how to produce alcohol, we wouldn't have had the first Middle East war, and we certainly wouldn't be having the wars we're having now, because we wouldn't need the oil.
So how are you working to avoid those kinds of censorship issues with your project now?
Well, we learned our lesson. I mean, we had a single sponsor then, which was that PBS station. So the whole book project has been funded entirely by people loaning money to the project, which will get paid back out of book sales. So we haven't taken any corporate donations and no industry donations, even from the alcohol industry, so that we could be free to say what we need to say in the book and not be censored.
Great. Well, good for you. What kinds of studies have been done to measure the effectiveness of alcohol as a fuel?
Oh, gosh, there's been reams and reams of studies over time. You know, it seems like every 20 years there's another round of studies on alcohol fuel when gasoline has a burp in prices. I mean, since the London Omnibus Company in the 1900s did a very good study showing that alcohol tripled the engine life of their buses over gasoline. And that's because alcohol burns extremely clean compared to gasoline. No carbon builds up in a alcohol engine at all. The engine stays shiny inside. And carbon is like microscopic sandpaper, which is what wears out the rings and bearings in your vehicle. So that cleanliness, you know, that's really important also for our environment, because alcohol burns so efficiently that it's over 90% cleaner than gasoline. And that's, you know, something that we should all be concerned about. Even though, you know, modern cars put out less pollution than they did 20 years ago on gasoline, alcohol is 90% less than that. So, you know, when it comes to places like China that are choking with pollution now, and, you know, I just was in Atlanta recently, which has just solid smog all summer, you know, alcohol can make a huge difference. And that's been demonstrated in Sao Paulo, Brazil, where there used to be an enormous smog problem until the country largely converted to alcohol, and now Sao Paulo has relatively clean air, and it's the biggest city in the world.
I was going to ask about that, actually. I'm curious to know about the modifications that Brazil has made to any laws that they had in place that, you know, what changed to help them to become ethanol-fueled rather than gasoline-fueled?
Well, a couple of things. You know, Brazil was far away from anywhere where tankers went until after World War II. So Brazil was largely alcohol-powered right up into the 40s. And Buckminster Fuller was actually involved with Brazil in their alcohol system, you know, up until that time and a little after. So Brazil had not been off alcohol very long when in the 1970s we had the Arab oil embargoes and the price spike in gasoline that was felt all over the world, and the shortage. A lot of folks today weren't around during that period, and don't realize that Americans and people all over the world had to wait in line for hours to get gasoline because there was an actual embargo or shortage. So what happened with Brazil, which had a military government at the time, they just went to the sugar manufacturers and said, okay, you guys are going to start making alcohol. And they went to the car companies and said, you guys are going to start making cars run on alcohol again. And the car company said, oh, no, no. You don't understand, little Brazil. We're big, giant transnationals, and we can't retool our factories just because you want alcohol cars. And the, well, you know, when you're in a dictatorship, it's a little different. The Brazilian generals just said, read our lips, alcohol cars or else. And so in 6 months, they were rolling off the assembly line, you know, high compression, high performance alcohol engines that could run on pure alcohol. And up until about 88, 89, over 90% of the cars in Brazil ran on alcohol, and still a large percentage do today.
Well, it seems like what's striking about making the change to running on ethanol or alcohol in a country like America, where we all have to, a lot of different groups have to agree in order to get something passed, that this really brings people together across political spectrum and across industries as well.
Yeah, absolutely. For ever since George Bush the First took office with Ronald Reagan, there's been you know, a constant battle to try to reverse any of the incentives to try to promote alcohol fuel. And every time the Republicans try to pass one of these things, or have tried to pass them in the past, they not only lost, but the incentives got increased. Because what you find in the Midwest, where alcohol is produced from corn, is that it doesn't matter what party you're from. If you're against alcohol, you're just voted out. So the Republicans could never hold together and eject alcohol from a favored status. And that's been a good thing, because as a result, we've really matured as an alcohol industry in the United States and producing over 4 billion gallons a year. And that amount is, you know, ratcheting up a great deal right now. And we've got it to the point now where the big plants can produce alcohol for less than a dollar a gallon, which is quite a bit less than wholesale gasoline at this point. So, you know, the small incentives that alcohol has gotten over the years has really made the industry, you know, cost effective and continues to see improvements. But that, you know, these tax benefits, right now add up to about 61 cents a gallon. So a credit now, you know, for those of you who aren't way up on taxes, credits are something that comes directly off your taxes, not off the income before you figure the taxes. Those are deductions. So these are direct credits. Now, if you make alcohol yourself, you get to take that 61 cent a gallon tax credit off your taxes. And you can certainly make alcohol for less than a dollar a gallon, even on the small scale at home. Especially if you're using waste materials. So if you're making moonshine, which you can do legally, make it for a dollar a gallon, you get 61 cents off your taxes, you're really using 39 cent a gallon fuel. And it's better than gasoline.
If you're just joining me, this is Julie Sabatier. I'm talking with David Bloom. He's the author of a book called Alcohol Can Be a Gas, which is due out in the fall. So what kind of practical information does the book offer to people who might want to make their own alcohol?
Well, it's actually, you know, this is the first time in 100 years, really, a book has been written like this that's a complete thorough how-to on making alcohol from many different kinds of materials, many different kinds of crops, even kelp. You know, we talk about how to make alcohol from kelp. So the steps are all in there and how to do it, and also all the information you'd need to convert most any gasoline car and many diesel engines to run on alcohol. So it's and on top of that, it's also a toolbox for activists to organize people to be able to take control of the fuel system by either setting up cooperative stations to, you know, that people own instead of the oil companies to distribute the fuel, or working with farmer cooperatives that already exist to make sure that you're buying alcohol instead of from, you know, corporate giants, from actual groups of farmers that are operating large plants. But the most important thing I think the book shows is that on the small scale, you know, maybe anywhere from, you know, a few thousand gallons to maybe a couple of hundred thousand gallons a year, you can actually make a living if you have a a well-designed, permaculturally designed alcohol plant that integrates not just the alcohol, but all of its byproducts to produce different kinds of food and other products that basically end up hiring a lot of people and localizing economy.
Well, what kinds of products can you make from the byproducts of alcohol?
Well, I mean, we can start with kind of the standard ones. Like if you're making it from corn, which is the way most alcohol is produced right now in the United States, all you're removing from the corn is the starch. Starch is about 75% of you know, corn grain. The rest is protein and fat and all the good stuff. So the byproduct gets called dried distillers, grains, and solubles, which is, you know, the concentrated protein, et cetera, left over. It still looks like corn at the end. Now, that takes up about a third of the volume of the original corn. You can actually take that material, and instead of feeding corn to cattle, if you feed the dried distillers grains, you'll end up getting 17% more meat than you would if you would have fed the original corn. Now, that sounds a little bit like magic. You get your alcohol and you get more meat, you know. But the reason for that is cattle were never evolved to eat grain or grass. Cattle evolved in the forests of Europe. And so their stomachs are very good at digesting cellulose, which is a very different carbohydrate, and that's where they get their energy from. So they don't have the enzymes or the acid that we do in our systems to digest starch, and it goes through undigested and causes a lot of problems. So by making alcohol, we take the starch out first so it doesn't get wasted going through the cow, and we only feed what the cow really can digest really well, and they end up gaining more weight. So, you know, it's not a food versus fuel issue. You know, most of the corn in the United States is used for feeding cattle. So as I'm pointing out, we would actually get more meat. In other words, you could look at it a different way. What we're getting is alcohol is a byproduct of increasing the amount of food that is produced in the United States.
Well, what kinds of modifications are necessary to run a car on alcohol?
Well, it depends on your car. You know, some cars have been made since 1994 specifically to run on any mixture of alcohol and gasoline, and those are called flexible fuel cars. There's about 4 million of them on the road, and they've been made by almost all the U.S. manufacturers and some others like Mercedes and et cetera. And so they have a smarter computer, and that computer is able to adjust the air-fuel mixture for any ratio of alcohol to gasoline. See, alcohol needs less air than gasoline to burn. So those cars are already set up to run on either, and you don't have to think about anything. You just put whatever you want in the tank. If you want to go ahead and convert your current vehicle to alcohol, there's quite a number of ways to do it. We detail all this in the book so that people can, you know, look at the kind of fuel injection system they have and know what to do about their system. But for instance, on my 82 Volvo, basically there was one screw that I had to turn about 1.5 turns out, and bang, it ran on alcohol. So it was that simple in that case. That adjusted the air-fuel mixture. Other cars are, you know, might need an aftermarket computer added onto the current car's computer that can be reprogrammed to deliver a different amount of fuel for the amount of air, and that might cost a few hundred dollars, $200-$300. So it depends on the kind of vehicle. The other thing you do different for alcohol is take advantage of the fact that it's 105 octane, so it's super premium. And that means you can tune the car more like a race car, meaning that you can start the spark firing much earlier in the engine cycle than you would with gasoline. If you tried to do that in gasoline, you'd get pinging and knocking and all kinds of problems. But on alcohol, you just get more horsepower and you get better mileage. So, you know, those are the two main things, but there are many other tricks you can use to increase mileage as well.
So there are cars that are being made standard with engines that can run on alcohol now.
Oh, and more every year. In fact, we've been trying for the last few years to get a bill passed to make sure that all cars are flexible fuel in the U.S. because it costs the auto companies less than $50 a car on the assembly line to make cars to run on both.
I was going to ask what needs to change at the legal level for this to take off.
Well, you know, not much, because it's completely legal to make alcohol for fuel. We fought that battle in the 80s and won, And the permit now is free from the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms people. And you're able to make 5,000 gallons of alcohol per year without anything more complicated than a two-page permit. So it's already legal now to produce your own fuel. When it comes to air pollution laws, alcohol is so clean that in most states, you just have to pass the smog test. And, of course, you know, basically the people doing the test think something's wrong with their machinery because it's so clean. But in a few states, there is some legal problems where the laws protect the devices on the car from being tampered with versus the air. So in those cases, you usually have to apply for an experimental permit, which is another couple of pages, and then you can run legally on alcohol. So there's really very little in our way from going forward with this. And there's a lot of waste materials that we can start making alcohol from right away. You know, you don't have to grow crops, although there are quite a few good crops for making alcohol. I used to use donuts, for instance. You know, in my book I talk about this, how we used to use, day-old donuts from the local donut shops, and we'd cook that up to make the alcohol. And, of course, donuts are fried in fat, so the fat would float to the top. We'd skim the fat off, and we'd use it for all the energy we needed to fire the still, because, you know, you need to boil the mash and distill the vapors off to get the alcohol. So we actually, you know, used every part of the donut to be able to make our fuel and ended up not even using any wood or other energy to heat the still.
You heard it here on KBOO. Run your car on donuts.
Hey, you know, cops can only eat so many and then the rest go to waste.
So where can people access alcohol fuel?
Well, if you go to our website, which is permaculture.com, you'll be able to find a link there that takes you to a directory of all the alcohol fuel stations in the country. And on the West Coast, we have very few. The Midwest has several hundred. But there are many plans afoot in the last few months for many states to start increasing the amount of pumps that serve alcohol directly and that you can start putting in your car. Now, you know, one thing I didn't mention is you can start using alcohol without changing anything about your car. The modern normal fuel injection system will tolerate 50% alcohol, make, you know, all the adjustments itself necessary without having to do any changes to your car. So you can start running 50% alcohol almost right away. So if people got together and formed a driver-owned gas station, which we show how to do in the book, they could get all the tax credits, they could get their alcohol at wholesale, and you know, start recirculating that currency within their community instead of exporting it, you know, to oil companies somewhere else.
Well, I'm also curious about how alcohol lines up against other alternative fuels like biodiesel.
Well, biodiesel has, is a good fuel also. It like alcohol, does not increase carbon dioxide in the atmosphere because, like alcohol, it comes from plants, which use carbon dioxide to make the fuel. But plants don't make vegetable oil very well, which is where biodiesel comes from. You know, an acre of soybeans will only make 50 gallons of biodiesel. But an acre of sugar beets, which you grow quite a few of in Oregon, can make over 1,000 gallons of alcohol. So plants make carbohydrates much more easily than they do fats. Biodiesel, of course, only works in diesel engines, and only 5% of the engines on the road are diesel engines. So, you know, for those engines, biodiesel works great. Alcohol, of course, replaces gasoline, which most of our cars run on, and that makes it pretty useful. And it can even be used in diesel engines with a little bit more complex conversion. With biodiesel, no conversion is necessary to run a diesel engine on it. So both fuels have their place, and, you know, we should encourage both.
But alcohol, you can run a car that's not a diesel engine on alcohol, that's right?
Yes, absolutely, and very cheaply at that.
Well, we're rapidly running out of time here, but is there anything that you wanna say that we haven't covered before we go?
Sure enough. Wednesday night, we're going to be spending a lot more time talking about this as part of a program by Portland Peak Oil. So we're going to be giving I'll be giving a talk on the 21st, Wednesday, at 7 to 9 p.m. at the St. Francis Church Dining Hall. and that's at 1182 Southeast Pine Street in Portland. If you need a map or you need more details, you can go to www.portlandpeakoil.org and get more information about the talk. And, of course, if you want to, you know, be on the mailing list for when the book comes out and that kind of thing, you can go to our website. And also there's quite a bit of information on our website about alcohol. And our website is www.permaculture.com.
Great. Well, thanks so much. I've been speaking with David Bloom about his forthcoming book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas. And as he said, he'll be speaking at the St. Francis Church on Southeast 12th and Pine tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. And that's a Portland Peak Oil event, and it is free and open to the public. Thanks for joining me, David.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
I'm gonna go in. I had a drink on the day. Opinions were like kittens, I was giving them away. I had a dream the other day, I had a love taste. I said, you will come down soon too. You will come down soon too. You will come down soon too. Soon enough, you will come down. You will come down soon too. You will come down soon too. Come down, come down.
Tuesday morning radio zine. Stay tuned for a special edition of Stage and Studio coming up. And we have a ticket giveaway for La Bodega Productions' The Trial. This is at Theater at 3430 Southeast Belmont. And we have two pairs of tickets. If you have won anything in the last 30 days from KBOO, you are not eligible, and we want people to call the front desk, and you should be a KBOO community member. And that number is 503-231-8032.